covered that in there. That was the beginning of an organization as far as the building trades was concerned. Only the building laborers, though, you may say participated to any extent. The others were just, with the exception of a few militants who also participated, there was no leadership involved, with the exception of just a couple of unions, the Lathers, who was working with the organizer for the building laborers, organizer in name, but never done any organizing, up until the time that the workers began to move, and then the pressure from mainly the Lathers forced this organizer, I forget just what his name was, to get in there and organize these people. But following that, there wasn't much of a struggle on the part of the building trades as such. They wasn't involved in it as a whole, neither did they take much interest. They were mostly just what we used to call pie card artists, and while the union treasurers was being just depleted, mainly of paying out salaries, why, still there was no move as far as the leadership was concerned. But the first movement was mainly in the metal trades. Now this was quite interesting because prior to any organization, there was a few of us who know that if we start a union, that is, and give it the name of a union, why, workers would immediately be fired if they came to any meetings of any kind. So for a while, we organized what we called the Tool and Die Makers Club, mainly tool and die makers and machinists among the progressive and left wing, and we were able to involve a large number of metal trades workers, mainly in the machine building and the tool and die makers. But then the call came out for organization of industrial unions. Prior to this time, there had been the Trade Union Unity League, which was mainly an educational organization agitating for industrial unions. But there had been no concrete organization set up any place in the country until the Trade Union Unity League decided now something has to be done besides just education and propaganda. And the result was conventions was called for this purpose, in which many over the country from the existing organizations of the AFL, which was practically the only organization, and a few independents, weak independents, I might add, there was numbers of people who turned up at this national convention. And there a program was drawn up, and policies on how to go about organization, realizing that those who still had jobs wanted organization and needed organization, and if given proper leadership, they would organize. But it had to be an organization that started out with one main understanding in mind, which was a very fundamental point, and that was the protection of the workers on the jobs, protecting their right to organize, even to the extent of using strike methods, whatever means could be used to prevent the companies from discriminating and firing them, which had been a national policy all over, in which the AFL was doing nothing about. At the most, you could say, writing a few letters or something of that kind. But there was no concrete example set.
Minneapolis was a notorious
Of any way to actually protect the workers, which meant even those who were union-minded, would like to have an organization. Well, it's just nature, you know. They have to exist, they have to live, even if the miserable conditions they had, the miserable wages and everything of that kind, part-time work. Many workers, I mean all over the country, it's a matter of record, both worked and had to get whatever relief they could. That was the way they were existing in those days. But after the TUUL had called these national conventions, and in the policy, it drawed up the ways to proceed to organize workers. That is, there had to be divisions. It can't be just one big union, as some of the left-wingers used to talk about. Just one big union doesn't work, because the workers' interests are different on different jobs. Their problems are different, so the one big union, well, even at the convention, there was those advocates, but nevertheless, a correct formula was worked out, and that was a division of, like, say, for instance, the one that I was in, metal trades, which includes all metal, all workers who handle metal from the very making of the steel or aluminum or whatever it happens to be, right on down to where these metal workers make the finished product. And the same thing applied in mining, all miners. While in this form of organization, certainly there has to be some separations, because the problem, for instance, of the steel worker who makes the steel is considerably different than the machinist or the tool and die maker who puts out the finished product of it. So within this division of industrial organizations, there must also be the other divisions whereby they can specifically take care of the problems of this branch of that industry. And of course then the steel and metal workers was set up. That is the skeleton of the steel and metal workers. And each one of these different divisions was to call to start organizing, education, organization as much as possible, and the calling of conventions to further formulate specific programs that would be the most effective in these different branches of industrialism,
But the workers scared to join organizations?
Yes, that's true. And that was the thing that we realized that we had to overcome. Otherwise, you could build no organization unless you could overcome firing of workers. Mm-hmm. And in each one of these organizations, that was a central policy. Now, we'll proceed to where we bring this right down home here. In Minneapolis, we became quite successful. I mean, the program was carried into the shops where the workers was still at work. Of course, you've usually found mostly just skeleton crews. The unemployed situation was big, 17 million, I believe, is what they estimated. But nevertheless, those few workers that you found, they were wanting organization. But again, I have to repeat, they had to be assurance that this didn't mean the losing of their job, regardless of how miserable that job was. And this was an assurance that was given, and plans laid how to protect them. Not the old way of writing letters. But there's one thing that we must understand. And first, and I have to again speak about the unemployed movement. The unemployed movement was billed and was the largest mass organization that there was in existence at that time. But they were built along the line of unity with the workers who are still working. And they were very well educated, especially here in Minneapolis. They never had difficulty in any place where there was a strike of the unemployed going in and attempting to break the strike. There may be an exception now and then. Maybe poverty forced someone in who didn't understand or something like that, economic conditions and such. The unemployed was the backbone of the picket lines here. And among this, it was taken up with the unemployed organizations to not only have unity with the employed workers, so that if the time comes that they ever can go back to work, well, at least they will go back to work under better conditions, whereby if they went in and attempted to break the strike, they weren't only cutting the throats of the other workers, they were cutting their own throats in case they ever have to go back, because they would have to work under the miserable conditions that they themselves helped to create. And they
saw that in the back.
And they knew that. I mean, after this point had been brought up, mm-hmm. and this was a constant discussion in there. Well, we could cover a lot of things that happened, I mean, that proved disunity, which we'll have to skip over. But in each instance, it was the same. Now, getting down to concrete organization with the shops. Well, first, the National Convention was called of metal workers, which wasn't a convention in which you had to be a member of a union. Of course, we wanted to get as many delegates as we could from existent unions, and there was many even AFL unions that came there who still had their charters. But there was just rank and file workers from shops, some of them that was just elected. When the word went out, even if you have no organization, elect or appoint somebody to attend these conventions. And the result was they really responded. The metal workers was set up as an organization. The Steel and Metal Workers Industrial Union was set up in a convention in Pittsburgh. I believe it was in 1934. Now, I might be off, as I say, on dates. But, and of course, from the National Convention, there was elected for the various districts. I believe the United States was divided up into 9 districts. And there a committee for each one of these districts was set up, with a secretary right at the National Convention, elected by the representation that happened to be there from that district. And it happened in this case that I was elected the secretary for this district, covering western Wisconsin, the Dakotas, and Minnesota. And I believe Iowa was included in it. And, of course, coming back with a very good committee already formed at the National Convention, we proceeded to attempt the organization. Well, we had, as I said before, we had pretty good success considering those days. I want to state here that all over the country they didn't have this good of a success. And it also, as I said before, this was a metal trades union, industrial organization. In many places, and one of them, like Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, which is a very big steel town, they attempted the firing of workers right away. But for the first time, for many, many years, probably way back to 1919, for the first time, a big steel mill was completely shut down and held closed. Not only by the workers within the shop or within the steel mill, but by and through the help of the unemployed who came there. And of course, when it came out in the paper here, they just laughed about, what could this organization do? It has no national background. It hasn't got anything. But nevertheless, before they was over, they had to sign an agreement. The first agreement, I believe, that was signed by the steel mills, and at least from many, many years. And then there was other places that I just can't name right at this time. Also, in Pennsylvania, this went through Youngstown, Ohio, number of other places. This new infant organization that came up with this militancy and honest leadership and determination was able to do things that Bill Green says was impossible to do. Sam Gomper said it was impossible to do. Their policy was you just got to organize a little weak employer. And that always remained the policy up until the time that the CIO came into existence, or rather, I got a little bit ahead of my story. This organization that I'm talking about, the Trade Union Unity League, with its branches of industrial organizations, was forerunners to the CIO and actually set the example of how organization could be made, and the CIO remained. In the main, an organization based on the very program and principles, used the same formula and methods as was already being done in the time that I was speaking about when these strikes took place. But as I said again, here in Minnesota, we were quite lucky. But we were building organization. A couple of figures here is quite interesting. And that was, we got this, at least I got, figures directly from the international representative here in Minneapolis, or in this district, who was in the Machinist Union, the AFL, at that time. They told me, I was razzing them, well, why don't you do something? Well, what can you do? Our whole membership of the district of the Machinist Union here is 280 members. Well, the steel metal workers wasn't in existence only just a matter of weeks, until we had already had 800 workers here. Well, there's another thing that's interesting. Prior to the time that these industrial unions was built and the steel and metal workers, I was one who they wouldn't let into the Machinist Union. I was barred, along with a number of other people who had been expelled because of their left-wing activities years past. The doors was never reopened to them. I mean, in fact, many places they use gangsters. Like in Chicago, they had what they call the Notorious Fry Gang. And it didn't only operate in Chicago, it operated all over this part of the country here. They had goons and gangsters that beat up the left-wing workers if they even came near a meeting, or if they went near a shop or anything else. They went out and done the dirty work of beating them up. Well,
how'd you get by those guys when you started in?
Well, when we started in, we didn't know, and it so happened that with the exceptions of a few threats, they never came up here to Minneapolis. But in Chicago, there they did. They beat up many of them. And as I say, we proceeded to organize. But the point was that I wanted to make was, after we had built organization here, I mean the left wing, militant organizations, democratically run, in which the workers themselves, true reports was made in every meeting, the workers themselves laid out the program. I mean, naturally, leadership proposes certain things, but the entire membership became an enlightened and educated and a fighting membership, and one who had faith in their union because of the honest leadership that was in there. But this was a very interesting thing. Well, of course, there was quite a bit of publicity. Even once in a while, the papers would put something in about unions. I mean, I'll just give you one concrete example. I was working in the Caterpillar tractor. I worked there from 1928 to 1933, I believe it was. And in fact, I was there among the last when they moved away from here and went to Peoria. We were organized. There wasn't much publicity about our organization, but the workers, we workers in the shop, knew we had an organization. The national policy all over the country was for wage cuts. In fact, it was in the paper that the National Chamber of Commerce or the National Manufacturers Association or whatever different organizations the employers had at that time, they had a national policy on which they had all agreed, 15% wage cut throughout the country. And it also applied to the railroads. And, of course, they were just getting by with it. They were just getting by with it, even in organized shops, just put up a bulletin and say, as of such and such a day, wages will be cut by 15%. Some of them were a little more lenient and only took 10. Many of them also took 20. But nevertheless, with workers without any organization, and the leadership, and even Bill Green in many places sanctioned these. I mean, we must work on a cooperative basis to keep industrial going and so on and so forth, and the workers took their wage cuts. But when it come to those in which we had many places only skeletons of organization as far as the new industrial organizations were concerned, there the employers was challenged on this. And throughout the country in many places, they were stopped cold. And here in Minneapolis, in the Caterpillar Tractor, where I will say the largest proportion of this 800 membership that I talk about came from. Prior to the time of the convention and the setting up of actual organization, it was a completely independent organization, just among us workers there in the shop. But when they put up the notice on the clock of the 15% wage cut, immediately the committee challenged it, went to the office. Of course, the company didn't think. I mean, they just, in those days, thought they could just laugh it off. There's nothing to this. And while at the same time, we challenged the company there with what organization we had, when the workers in the shop knew that this bulletin was up, they were going to get a 15% wage cut, and that we had challenged it, and we called on the workers for all of them to support and come into the union that hadn't come in yet, they just flocked in. And we had nearly 100% organization in that shop. And of course, this became known to the company. Naturally, they have stool pigeons, that the workers had really organized in this shop. And we went in on a Monday morning and told the superintendent that there would be no wage cut there. And unless that notice was off of the clock, Wednesday morning, when we came into work, that's the morning of the wage cut. After all, they didn't give you 2 or 3 weeks notice to go cut your wages. They just give you 1 day, 2 days, or 3 days, and they just cut them. But we told them that Wednesday morning. And when Wednesday morning come, the workers come to the door of the shop. But they didn't go in. Not one solid worker, with the exceptions of a committee, who went in to look over every clock in the every clock in the whole industry. They have many different buildings there, to see if there was any bulletins left. We went back in, and there wasn't a bulletin on the clock. We went to the office, and the company said, well, there will be no wage cut. But there was one thing interesting here, I think, that you should also know. In the Caterpillar Tractor, while they had different plants over the country, this was the only one that was running to any extent. And it was running full blast. But it was running on a contract that they had with the Soviet Union. And the superintendent says to me, I was spokesman for the committee that we had, he says, well, now, he says, if we could collect all of the money that's owed to us directly, the Caterpillar Tractor as such, well, we possibly wouldn't have to make this wage cut. Of course, we knew, workers knew in the shop who we're working on, whose product we're putting out, who was buying it. $15 million, this is quoting what the superintendent, if it wouldn't be for the $15 million contract that we had with the Soviet Union, we would also be closed down. And he enumerated the various states, North and South Dakota, and he says as far east as the state of Rhode Island, and in most cases, or several states, he told us how many thousands, or even hundreds of thousands, that these states owed the Caterpillar Tractor for their road machinery and different machinery that they'd put out. Well, I says to him, well, how about the Soviet Union? Did they pay or do they pay? Oh, yes, yes, we couldn't do business with the Soviet Union. They have gold bullion right in New York, pays for every item before it ever is loaded onto the boat. And I says, you're getting your money from the Soviet Union. You want to cut our wages, so that you won't have to collect your money from, well, what's the matter with that? This here country that you're talking so much about all the time, and there's always propaganda wherever you look against it. Why is it? that they pay, and you keep this big factory going on their business, and here in our own country, in the United States, all of these hundreds of thousands of dollars is owed by them, and they can't pay it, and that's the reason you want to cut our wages. Well, I says, that's a very good reason why we don't accept it, you know, among other things. But that's here was along with it, I'll tell you the big jip it was to it, too. This here is personal experience that I had. I was a machinist there, and I run short on some of the things that I was working on. I remember I was turning down rollers that a big belt runs on to carry dirt from these dirt machines. Now, I think that was what, I'm quite sure that was it. I was turning down the shafts that went through these. Well, anyhow, I run out of them, and the fellow who had been working over on the drill press, who had been putting the shafts through these tubing, and there was a casting in the end of each tubing, and they put a pin down through the castings in each one, and that made a roller out of it, you see? Well, I had run out of them, and there was nobody who made any more, and the foreman says to me one night, well, if you're out of work, why don't you go over and make a few of them? And then come back on your machine, because you could do that so much faster over there than I could on the lathe. I mean, you could do this drilling and put the pin in and to hold the casting and the shaft solid and rivet it over. You could. It was a quite simple operation. So I said, all right. I went over and made a bunch of them. Well, the thing I had to do, I had to put the two castings in the end, that is one in each end of a piece of tubing. Then I had to put a hole. Well, first the castings were drilled that would just fit this shaft. And of course there's a bunch of the castings laying there on one rack, the tubing on another one, and shafts on the other one. It was just a matter of putting the two pieces of castings in each end, shoving the shaft through the holes of the castings that had already been made, drilling a hole down through the tubing, casting, and shafting, and putting a pin through there and batter it over. That made a solid rig out of it, you see. Well, I didn't pay any attention. It was all piecework in the shop there, so I didn't pay any attention about it. I just went over there and drilled a few holes and put the pins in them and went back over to work on my machine. Of course, I knew that being piecework, that there is something on it, and of course it has to all be charged up. And I worked over there probably 2 hours doing that. And then I had plenty, of course, to last me over there, where on my job there would last me a couple of days. But before I went to make out my time card, I asked the foreman, well, what do I put down over there? And, of course, he went in and he looked at the slip that gives you the prices on everything. Well, I'll tell you, it wouldn't take long to get rich if I had that job. I forget all of the different ones, but to give me 8 cents a piece for just putting the shaft through the holes, and you could do it just as fast as I could tell you. It was a matter of just picking up the shaft, putting it in there, and the result is, in less than 2 hours, I had made more than 2 days' wages. Of course, because they only allowed you to make a dollar an hour, otherwise you cut the price. But I bring this in to only show you how they gypped. Their contract was that they had a 20% plus contract, something like we find now in a lot of shops and have for a long time, you know. The bigger expense that they can run up, well, the more money they get out of it. It shows it costs so much. But it's pretty ridiculous when you could do that. Well, we'll go on now with the trade union organization. Now, after the machinists, of course, there had been some heat put on this international representative who personally was a very good friend of mine. At one time was a left-winger. Hussman, his name was. I don't know. A lot of people still remember Hermann Hussman. At one time in the First World War, he was a German. He was a good progressive guy at that time. He was put in jail. Rejailed, like they do nowadays, you know. Tempting, if somebody is halfway decent and wants to do something, not for himself and his fellow workers. If they can get anything on you, they want to deport you. And of course, he was in the labor movement at that time, doing something, considered a very good, honest man at that time. But somehow, when he got out of jail after that, he was never the same Herman Hussman. Whether he agreed to be a good boy, as they like to have you be good, you know, or not, nevertheless, he didn't do anything except just draw his salary. But heat was put on him from the International to get some organization. The result was he couldn't get an organization. Workers here had no confidence whatever in the leadership. They had already, and I'll show you in just a little later on, how we put workers back to work, made the employer pay them for time that they said that they had been fired for only belonging to the old conservative machinist union that didn't have a bit of fight in it. And 2 years later, we put them back on the job because they were actually fired because of union activity, so-called. That's what the charges were. Well, I don't know if this was direct orders from the International Association of Machinists or whether it was Hussman who took the initiative in doing it. We had a hall here in town, and it was a hall of activity. Every night there was meetings going on, committee meetings, the mass meetings, the union meetings, business meetings, social affairs, and so on and so forth. There was life and there was activity there, and workers had reached the point they weren't scared to come anymore. In fact, we were thinking about having to get a larger hall. One night, on a membership meeting night, who come to the door but Herman Hussman himself and ask if he could be admitted to the union, if he could attend the union meeting. Well, of course, you just couldn't say yes or no right off to him like that, because after all, the workers, they didn't have any confidence. They would wonder what he wanted to come to a meeting of that kind for. But it was immediately taken up and explained. I did the explaining myself. After all, certainly he can't do any harm here. He's not a stool pigeon, I don't think, and I don't think anybody else would believe that Herman was a stool pigeon. And the result was he was admitted to the meeting. And he sat there all the way through that meeting. And from where I was, facing him, it seemed very much as though he was enjoying it. Maybe it was reminding him of something that happened back many years ago. But anyhow, he enjoyed it. But after the meeting, he asked me if I would stay for a while and talk with him. Well, there was certainly nothing against that. He represented one union, I represented the other, and I didn't think the workers was any scared about me being ensnared by anything that Herman may have to offer, and the result was we did. And we spent the whole night in the office together, the whole entire night. It was getting daylight. And this was mainly what he come there for. He come there to ask us, who they wouldn't even take into the union before, ask us to bring our union into the machinist union. Of course, immediately the question was asked of him, well, Herman, are they going to take me in? Yes, sir, I have assurance from the International. There'll be no discrimination against anybody. They have realized that they cannot organize the workers. And the only way they can organize the workers is when they bring these people in who have been thrown out before, because otherwise their whole organization was going to die. Well, it was going to die. In fact, an organization of that kind, we were even going to help kill it. And, well, just to show you an example, I told you about that we had 800. We had more than that this night that Herman was there. I don't know how many we had. I think it was between 1,400 and 1,500 members. They couldn't get in the hall anymore. And when he seen that activity and those members and the democratic method that everything was handled in that union, as I said, he looked kind of happy about it. Well, I said that we were going to help to kill it. Anything like that, that only collects dues from the workers, has no right of collecting dues just so that somebody can live off of it, and then while they collaborate with the employers. Well, of course, this took a lot of consideration, even after the offer was made to take everybody back in. But the thing that impressed him the most was when he looked over there and he saw a stack of more than 200 books. Now, we didn't charge a big initiation. These organizations did. It was $1 initiation and $1 a month dues. And that organization functioned on that little amount. Of course, there wasn't the big salaries in the organization. Much of it was volunteer work, as far as organizers and those were concerned. But he seen, Herman Hussman seen over 200. You either pay a dollar dues, but if you have a book and are already a member, that is your initiation. And when Herman seen those books there, and these people became initiated, they had dug up old books. We didn't care if it was even an old book that they had. He seen over 200 machinist books there. Well, I guess he was quite convinced that what we told him was true, that you will either get out and organize or your organization will be forced completely out of existence. It has no right of existing because we had a militant fighting organization. But anyhow, it was taken up and considered for a period of some time. You just couldn't make snap judgment. It first had to be verified through the Grand Lodge of the International Association of Machinists. We weren't just taking Herman Hussman's word for it. The result was he wrote and we wrote. I wish I had those letters today say they were about the most friendly letters you ever seen that came back. We were so welcomed into the AFL, not only in that one, but in all of them in time. We went back into the AFL. I joined 1313 because that was mainly the one that applied to the kind of work that our workers within our union belonged to. Some of the others joined old 382. 1313 is existing today here. It has thousands of members, even though the left happens to be out again. But nevertheless, when I went in, there was one thing I wanted to know, now just how many members have we got? Well, the workers didn't respond to coming in to the machinist union at that time. And of course, they had the choice of still maintaining their union and at the same time joining in unity with the old so-called established organizations. And of course, the more advanced workers, you may say, which there were not too many and their workers weren't too far advanced at that time. But nevertheless, those who did understand trade unionism more thought that the policy of unity was good, regardless of who the leadership was, regardless of the size of the organization they had. That was not the important thing. The important thing was to get in, knowing that this new membership that had came into this industrial unions, and there was one thing we insisted on. I had the letter for years. The International Association of Machinists agreed, and in their next convention in Portland, Oregon, passed a resolution whereby that the Machinist Union will build industrial organizations. Any place where there's no other organization that exists and the Machinist Union goes in, they will build industrial. And I also remained as secretary, district secretary of the steel and metal workers, because we still had organizations in existence, the Griffin Wheel in St. Paul, the Malleable Iron in St. Paul, I think a couple of other shops. These workers were so deaf against the AFL, they had been sold out years ago, they just wouldn't go back in. And the result was, these organizations that I just mentioned stayed independent until the CIO came along. Before they would go in, they were just that scared, and of course, you can't force them to do something against their mind. But getting back to the night we went in, I was to remain as an organizer, which wasn't too particular. I would just soon had somebody else to be the organizer, but the workers who went with me insisted, and this was all agreed on, with the International Association of Machinists, democratic elections, The officers that we have now will also become officers. We made a sort of a unity executive committee of both unions, of the AFL 1313, International Association of Machinists, and of our Steel and Metal Workers Union. But this was very interesting. When I checked up on the books, an organization that had had 1,200 members in the past, I don't know how long past it was, but they actually had, the night that I went in, 33 paid up members in that union. 1313 of the International Association of Machinists, which now again has thousands of members. Well, at the first election, when the first election come up, then I was elected organizer for the International Association of Machinists. But bearing in mind, organizer not on the policies that they had, but organizer on the policies that we had carried into the organization. Industrial unions, protecting of workers on their jobs, and all of this. Well, we wasn't in long, and of course they begin to discuss it. When you talk about, well, we've got to put on an organizational campaign. The workers then who were in there began to raise the question, my gosh, look, all the guys gets fired. They had 100 and some, or 200, I don't know, I believe it was 184, the right there of a matter of record, who had been fired over the past 2 years. And the most they ever got was a letter from the International Association of Machinists requesting, begging, some places demanding, and never followed up, which is worse than as though they didn't even send a letter. But, of course, they had to be assured. By the way, these 33 that was in there seemed to be located in some shops that maybe you could say wasn't quite so bad. I could name you one shop in town that the majority of them belonged to, who owned a shop, used to be an old former socialist. And most of those workers were from that shop. And he didn't discriminate, even though there's lots of pressure put on him, he admitted that. They have deserted the union. Who is it that has been a good union man? And through inquiring around and acquaintances and well, I might say that we had one advantage here, right here, mainly applying to myself. I'm not speaking for someone else. By that time, I had been pretty well known in Minneapolis. I mean, you couldn't hardly take a relief committee down to the courthouse when I was in the unemployed movement unless your name popped up into the paper. And, of course, I already recorded some of the activities that took place in that unemployed movement, and not only the organization that we had of the unemployed, but in these same shops, as I mentioned before, there was a lot of guys who had to come to us in the unemployed movement to get relief to help to subsidize the wages that he made in the shops so that he and his family could live at all. In fact, the guy that was working in the shop, he was practically no better off than the guy on relief. 35 cents an hour, tool and die makers. 15, 17 cents an hour for laborers and things like that. Those were actual wages, and I'll come to the Flower City, which will bring out all of these things. Now, when we began to organize, of course, they began to put the spotters. And this happened within a matter of a week or 2 weeks. Immediately, we went out and started to organize. As soon as we took our new organization in there, they wasn't satisfied to take your time. Just get out there and do a job. And we did. And, of course, after contacting workers in each shop, holding house meetings with them, they in turn bringing their friends over there, the workers began to feel an assurance. But as soon as the company with their spotters and stool pigeons that used to come and stand at the hall doors, wherever the meeting was called, go back into the shop the next day and bang, they were out. Well, as soon as they done that, immediately we sent a letter. We called up. We gave them just a certain length of time to put them back and pay them for all the time. Well, getting to the after we had held, now this year, remember, is after we had held numbers and numbers of house meetings, with good guys. And of course, it took a little while before the employer was able to trace down everybody with their stool pigeons. But then, of course, they began to realize, well, there is something happening here. We just got to get rid of these guys. They didn't want to get rid of those who happened to attend a meeting and was caught, but they also got rid of anybody who happened to be carrying a card in lots of places. In the so-called reactionary or conservative places, there was still union men carrying a card that never said a word, and the result was the employer tolerated them. As long as they didn't do anything, well, they wasn't bothered about them. But when the organization and these demands began to be made, boy, they began to even fire old-timers that just because they had a card, had stayed in the union for years because of patriotism to the union or pride that they wanted to carry a union card, which used to be quite a thing among several of the old-timers. Well, in a matter of 2 weeks, we had numbers, I think it was 70-some workers, who we could definitely put our finger on was fired because they attended a meeting. We just took the whole list. And of course, our organization had began to grow, but not very fast yet. It took real action. The workers wouldn't just flock in to see what's going to happen to this number of people who had been fired. So, wrote a letter to every employer with the name of the worker, the day he was discharged, demanded that they place them back on the job and pay them for the time off, and we didn't mince any words. We just told them, and unless it happens, as we told, we said it should happen, which was only fair, your place will be shut down. Well, I wish I had some of the letters that those employers sent back to us. You should see them. Many of them, they might just as well, to sum it up short, just go to hell. Why, we whipped you, we whipped every organization we ever had, and especially this applied to the Flower City Ornamental Ironwork, which had been the key in busting the molder strike in 1919. That was the concentration of the employers. But it was a general thing. It wasn't just exactly a form letter, because each answer was a little bit different from this number of shops that had fired the workers. But anyhow, we gave them a certain number of days, not weeks. Well, this brought up a very important question in the union. Brother Husman, who had been there, was very much scared. He knew the organization had been growing, but he couldn't understand, even with a couple hundred, now it had grown from 32 or 3 or 4, up to where there was a couple of hundred or more, possibly near 300. How in the hell, because it involved 14 shops that we had sent this letter to that had fired men. Now how are you going to go out with a couple hundred or 300 men and shut down 14 shops? And he put up a big argument on the floor. And of course it required a lot of rebuttal. Again, having confidence in the workers being either employed or unemployed, we knew it could be done. At least we felt it could be done. It had never been tried yet. And, of course, Husman, while he even had a big organization, was afraid to protect the rights of the workers, because they always stated, well, this is tough times, depression's on, and if anybody goes out, in other words, we've got to take the wage cuts, we've got to have our conditions worsened, and so we just got to put up with whatever the employer gives us, hoping for better times sometime, you know, because if we do it this time, well, millions of unemployed people will take our job. That was their philosophy. But the philosophy of us was different. Having confidence in the workers, knowing that they would fight, and knowing that the amount of education that we'd carried on, we knew and was quite sure that we could shut down 14 or 40 shops if need be. And this was the answer. It was explained to them that 280 workers is not going to win this strike. The people in Minneapolis will win these strikes when they know what the issues are, and that they know about all of these firings and the miserable conditions, because they're all living under those miserable wages and miserable conditions, the people in Minneapolis will support it. Of course, he was so far overruled that he just sat down in the corner. He did make a few sarcastic remarks. Okay, go and break your neck or so on and so forth. Well, that will be our hard luck if we do, Herman. You've broke yours long ago, but at least we'll break it in a fight, not like you did, sitting in the chair and getting your wages. These were usually the answers that was given to him. But anyhow, the morning that the strike was called, if my memory serves me right, it was on a Wednesday morning, at 9 o'clock, all 14 shops were shut down, including the largest one at the Flower City. That was the last one that was closed down. Well, now this brings it up to a pretty important thing, because it was a desperate struggle. Probably didn't get the publicity of many other strikes, but I'll tell you, it was the most militant strike that was fought any place in the country outside of possibly the West Shore, West Coast longshoremen out there in their general strike. I mean, a strike that stood up to everything that the employers could use. Their entire police forces, with all of their tear gas cars, with everything else that they had. That strike was victorious. Now, I'll give you a little details how it became. I said there were 14 shops was closed down by 9:30 or 10 o'clock. Not a thing. I mean, the thing was, when we went to one shop, the workers welcomed us in there. They didn't fight to stay on their jobs. They came out. They walked out, and they didn't only walk out of the shops. Them that wasn't in the union yet, we asked them, brothers, go to the union headquarters and sign up. And they went there. And in one day, there was more than 2,000 workers. I mean, they weren't all in these shops even. But in one day, more than 2,000 workers signed up. It took two or three people busy in the line when they knew that these 14 shops were shut down. But the way they worked, they went to the one shop, those workers come out of there, they walked with them to the next shop or road or whatever way they got there, and those that didn't go to the strike headquarters and sign up in the union, they just went to the next shop until they were all shut down. By, as I said, by 10 o'clock at least, everything was completely shut down. Picket lines was established. And in this case, I guess the employers began to realize, well, by God, we have got something here to fight. They didn't attempt to reopen right away. Well, there was a couple attempts on the part of the Flower City immediately the next day. That was one shop that they didn't go down through, if I remember, I'm quite sure. They didn't go through and close it. But they figured on, well, just let them go out tonight and tomorrow morning. Of course, we also invited all the workers, and when they come out of the shop, picket line was already there. It wasn't a fight that we had to have with the workers. The workers walking out of the shop was hurraying and applauding their hands when they seen that picket line out there. Well, they attempted to open it two or three days. They sent out the executives and the supervisors and the foremen to visit the workers and assure them, well, ain't nothing to this. Come on down tomorrow and we'll get in the shop. Well, on one day, the workers come by theirself, and they got out there in groups and they stood around. I mean, those that did want to go in, not that they didn't want a union, but they were caught between the devil and the deep sea. They were caught between what we says we will protect you and what the employer says they can't protect you. So they didn't know what to do, and they would come down and assemble in groups. But there was no attempt on the part of trying to break through. So when they seen they couldn't get them in that way, then the foremen and the bosses of every kind, including the very top one, Mr. Tetzlaff, who was always crowed about the great role he played in busting the strike in 1919. They went out, they got the workers in cars, and they brought them down right to the door. And in a couple instances, why they was able to get in, a few, maybe five or six or something like that. Not enough to do any good in a plant that probably at that time was employing between 200 and 300. They were running slack as everything else was. But anyhow, not enough to do any harm. And if they did go in one day, if they got in four or five one day, the worker wouldn't show up the next day. just natural principle or working class instinct. But anyhow, that's the way it went. And finally, it reached the point that some of them thought, well, they're going to starve them out. Well, how the hell could they starve them out? Well, because the workers were already practically starving. I mean, they were just as well off to be entirely out of the shop and be fully on relief as there was to be part-time in the shop and then have to go to relief for the rest of it, because it all amounted to the same thing. And of course the workers began to understand it. And of course at that time, through the struggle of the unemployed, we had a setup in which they could get an existence on relief. And besides union only functioning as a striking, fighting, and picketing organization, they also functioned down to that courthouse if anybody was refused relief. It took care of all of the various phases of the workers' welfare as best could be done in those days, which was plenty miserable yet. But along with the demanding of the workers being reinstated and paid for all time lost, we also presented a concrete program of demands, which consists of union recognition and seniority rights, a thing today that just as good a contract as you can find in any shop today, with a lot less verbiage and language in it, but something that the workers understand. You can put all of these big fancy contracts that they have today, you can put the whole thing on one little simple sheet of paper, and every worker will know what you're talking about. But of course now they've got in this legal terminology, and they've got more doggone phases and this and that and the other. And but anyhow, that was as good a contract as they could draw up today. I haven't seen one, and I've talked to a lot of workers. I went down to CIO Hall. I talked to the old boys who's still there, who was in leadership of the organization in that time, and I asked them, why do you make these kind of contracts? Well, I don't know. This guy comes in, and of course, they have to have an attorney nowadays. We didn't have an attorney. We had the workers, that's all. And we says, now, is this what you want? If it is, we put it down, and we make it just as short as possible. When you read it, they knew everything we wanted. We demanded, there was no wage scale as such in Minneapolis. In the so-called union shops that Mr. Hussman still claimed was a union shop, they had no wage scale. So we had nothing to go by. But what we could work out ourselves. There was only the one wage scale, and that was the building laborers, or the city workers, I should say, had a scale. And the park board workers had a scale. Well, now most of this work is common work, common labor. And their scale was 62.5 cents an hour. So we put in the contract the minimum wage of 62.5 cents an hour, based on what was being paid by the city and the park board, and I believe the state. I'm not too sure about the state.